David, thank you for sending me the information.
Oh.
I finally, after I wrote you, I realized I could get into my building. You know, with the building, they include a telephone number.
Really?
Well, no sooner has the rest of world jury joined in the Saint Talamata Levracha, and a few days in, here we are, nice bit of English weather. Yaakov, in the meanwhile, is exactly where we left him. He's about to meet Esav, and Vayishlach begins with his message towards Esav. Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Dalet, the opening pasuk of the parsha. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefonov El Esav Achiv. Yaakov sends Malachim. Rashi informs us these are actual Malachim, angels. Others would say that they are messengers. And what is the goal of this message? What's its intended purpose? Well, as he says in the end of pasuk Vav, Vayishlacha Lahagid LaAdoni, I am sending this message to tell you, limso chen be'inecha, to find favor in your eyes. That is to say, it's a message of appeasement. And there is much to comment on the contents and various elements of Yaakov's message, but I'd like to focus on one of these phrases, one of these terms, with the attendant explanation of Rashi, which is quite well known. But as we've seen on so many occasions, it's the Rashis that we know well that are the ones that most need our attention. And in Pasuk Hei, Vayitzav Osam Neymor, Ko Samrun La'aduni Leisav, he tells them, say the following to Esav, Ko Amar Abdecha Yaakov, so says your servant Yaakov, Im Lavan Garti Va'echar Ad Ata. I have been with Lavan, I've been staying or living with Lavan, and I have tarried until now. Okay. What is the meaning of the word im lavan garti? Rashi offers two perushim. I think the second is the one that people reach for first, but Rashi put it second for a reason. The first is alpi pshuto. The second one is definitely alpi midrasho, if not more. And what does Rashi say? Garti. Meaning, lo nasesi sarve chashuv. I never became a noble, a notable, an important person there. Elager, I was always considered to be a lightweight personality, always looked upon as something of an outsider. Okay, why is he mentioning this to Esav? Is Esav meant to feel bad for him? He never ran for office, he was never voted as mayor. Why should Esav be in any way interested in this? Rashi explains. The point of contention, or the most recent point, between Yaakov and Esav are the brachos that Yaakov took from Yitzhak that were intended for Esav. And now Rashi says, Ein cha kedai lisno osi al birchos avicha, shebirchani heve gevir la'achecha. And therefore, you don't need to hate me or to bear ill will towards me over the brachos that the father blessed Heve Givir Achecha. You shall be a notable personality, a master over your brother. Shaharelo Niskaima be. See, look at me. If I tell you the story of the last 20 years, I never really made much of an impression on people, was never looked upon as a gvir in any way, so the brachos were not fulfilled. Quite so. Good. So the question is, before we get to Rashi's comment itself, as we always ask, why does Rashi say anything? After all, Im Lavan Garti, I've been living with Lavan, seems to be more or less straightforward. Why does Rashi need to comment? I was never taken that seriously. No one ever really gave me that much kavod. Why does Rashi see all this in these straightforward words? Well, this brings us, of course, to a point which is well known in Lashon HaKodesh, but not so well known, lahavdil, in modern Hebrew. And that is to say that the word lagur and garti always has a very transient or temporary connotation. That is in distinction or in contrast with the word lashevet. The Hebrew word for to dwell somewhere long term is actually lashevet. If someone is there for a short while or a sojourn, that would be called lagur, as the brothers say to Paro, lagur ba'aretz banu lo yardu lehishtakeya sham. The intent was not to settle there. So if a person is only going to be there for a short while, that's called lagur. As we mentioned, nowadays, people don't talk that way. That's why it's important that often some of the nuances in Lashon HaKodesh, modern Hebrew is based on Lashon HaKodesh, but it doesn't always carry the same connotations. Certain things can be lost in translation, even within the same language. Because when a person would say that they've been living in Yerushalayim for 50 years, they say, Ani gar po chamishim shana. However long term it is, they say gar. Perhaps they're always under some threat from their landlord, and they are in an ongoing state of transition. But that's the term. If a person says, Ani yoshev b'Yerushalayim 50 shana, that would be translated as, I've been sitting in Jerusalem for 50 years, which would lead to other questions, but wouldn't be taken as an indication of where they live. And therefore, the distinction between lagur and lashevet is lost on the modern Hebrew speaker, but that's all the more important reason that it should not be forgotten. Interestingly, having said that, we do not use the word lashevet for to live, but someone who's a resident is called a toshav. So that's actually a bit of an inconsistency, because he's gar, but he's a toshav. Okay, I'm sure whoever worked that all out had something in mind. And if they didn't, it's too late. So therefore, Rashi is commenting, because Garti had been living with Lavan, and with Lavan he was there for a good 20 years. 20 years is a good innings, as they say. That's called Garti. And that's why Rashi says that the transient element of the word lagur does not come out in time elapsed, because 20 years is a long time, but rather in Yaakov's status. I was never sar b'chashuv, but rather was always something of an outsider, not taken that seriously. As we can appreciate, the question still needs, or Rashi still needs contemplation. Because it sounds, and one has to say this in the right way, but it sounds almost as if Yaakov is, shall we say, belittling the significance of Yitzhak's brachos for purposes of making the peace with Esav. As if to say, I think the reason why you hate me is because we both took the brachos very seriously. But look, in the end, nothing came of it, nothing happened, brachos didn't work, and therefore there's no need for any bad feeling. So it seems almost at the expense of the efficacy of the brachos, Yaakov is looking to make the peace. But that, of course, cannot be. He cannot make peace with Esav on the cheshbon of Kibbutz Av to imply that Yitzchak's brachos were not effective or were not powerful. But rather, as the Mefarshim point out, the key word here is the word bi, lo niskaima bi, as if to say, Yaakov is not impugning the power of the brachos per se. He's not saying those brachos could not have been fulfilled, but rather what he's saying is clearly they were not fulfilled through me. And that may be, as some explain, because Yaakov says, I was not deserving that the brachos should be fulfilled through me. Even if the bracha is given from a worthy bestower, it needs to be received by a worthy recipient. I wasn't zocheh that the brachas would be fulfilled through me. But that's not enough, because Esav could still say, and of course Esav will say, well, obviously they weren't fulfilled through you, because you're Yaakov. But I'm Esav. Had the brachas been given to me, they would have been fulfilled. So it's still a bone of contention. It's not enough to say, I wasn't a worthy recipient. They went to an unworthy recipient. Because Esav will say, well, if they would have gone to me, they would have gone to a very worthy recipient, and you still, therefore, rob me of the brachas. And that is why other Mefarshim understand that what Rashi means to say is lo niskaimu bi, the brachos were not fulfilled through me because they were fulfilled through you. As if to say, this leads us back to really one of the major questions of Parshas Toldos, that whole episode with Yaakov taking the brachos. namely, how can you take someone's brachas? As if to say, the setup is, and let's take the things in a straightforward manner. Yitzhak believes that the person before him is Esav, which means the brachas are intended for Esav. He thinks that it's Esav, but really it's Yaakov. So now the question is, who gets the blessings? Now we know, however that works, that it was Yaakov, because he was the one in front of Yitzchak. But it's not so straightforward at all. Abarbanel raises the question, how do you steal a bracha that's intended for someone else? And however it does work, what Yaakov is looking at least to appease Esav is by saying that perhaps it didn't work after all, meaning after everything I did to get the brachas, but he thought it was you, and look at you! I've heard great things. You're doing amazingly. You're a macher, and you're a heavyweight personality. And therefore, the end of the day, all of my efforts to steal the bracha from you didn't work because they weren't fulfilled through me, because they were fulfilled through you. And that is what Yaakov means to say. Interestingly, we see the way that the mefarshim of Rashi approach the words of Rashi themselves. There's a layer of illusion here, as Yaakov says, Lo niskaima bi, was not fulfilled through me. How so? Because the bracha of Yitzhak was Heve gevir la'achecha. You'll be a gevir, a dominant personality vis-a-vis your brother. Okay, Yaakov says, but it didn't happen. Why? Because garti, I was only a ger. If you look at the word gevir, and this is from one of the lesser quoted mefarshim of on Rashi called Be'er Heitev. If you look at the word gevir, you'll see it has four letters. Gimel, Beis, Yud, Reish. So the full blessing is to be a gevir. In the end, what did Yaakov become? A ger. Which means he has the gimel at the beginning and the reish at the end. And what's missing? The Beis and the Yud in the middle. And that's Lo Niskaima B. The B of Gevir was not fulfilled, leaving me as a ger. So these are different layers of Rashi's understanding of what Yaakov means, al derech hapshat, when he says, im lavan garti. There is one outstanding question, and it's fascinating because it will bring us back to the word, to Yitzchak's brachos that we know so well. Maskele David, Rabbi David Pardo, in his commentary on Rashi, asks a simple question. What does Yaakov mean to say? The brachas were not fulfilled, at least through me. How do you see that? Because look, no one ever took me seriously. So, we'll look at Yitzhak's brachas. Have a gevir lechecha. You'll be a gevir. But the truth is that Yitzhak didn't say you'll be a gevir wherever you go. Yitzhak didn't just say you'll be a gevir. He says you'll be a gevir lechecha, which means it's all about Yaakov's relationship with Esav. Is he dominant over Esav or the other way around? You can't test the brachas of Hevi Gevir La'achecha by seeing whether he's a gevir with a bunch of total strangers. So it's a very interesting shaila. I was a ger. Where? In Haran. Mazel tov. No one's talking about Haran. The brachas are not about Haran. The brachas are about Yaakov's relationship with Esav. So how does this prove anything? It's a very interesting shaila. And the answer to the Maskele David is more interesting still, because it leads us back to the words Hevi Gevir La'achecha, which we normally actually mistranslate. You'll be a dominant personality over your brother. The word for your brother in Hebrew is not achecha, it's achicha. Achicha means your brother. Ba achicha b'mirma, as we know. Achecha means your brothers. But that's very interesting, because the bracha to Yaakov is not that he'll be a gevir over Esav alone, but over all his brothers, which now leads us to a simple question. How many brothers does Yaakov have? And the answer is one, Esav. So if he only has one brother, so why is it phrased in the plural that you'll be gevir la'achecha? Clearly, the plural is used because Achecha refers not only to his immediate brother, who's Esav, but his broader family. They are included. They are his brothers. Who is his next most close relative? Is Lavan. Which means if the bracha of Hevi Gevir La'achecha would be fulfilled, it would have been fulfilled through Lavan, because Lavan is part of Achecha. And Lavan took Yaakov least seriously of all. And therefore, his experiences with Lavan are an indication of that the bracha of Hevi Giver La'achecha in the plural was indeed not fulfilled. Okay, sof davar, at the end of the day, having analyzed and discussed some of the details and the connotations, tachlis, Yaakov's message is one of appeasement. And moreover, we find similarly in Pasuk Vav, it corroborates this idea. What does Yaakov say in the beginning of Pasuk Vav? Vayihi li shor v'chamor, which literally translates means I had an ox and a donkey, which doesn't seem to be of interest to anyone, but practically it means that I've acquired oxen and donkeys. The generic singular is used, but it refers to livestock generally. Okay. And here, too, we ask, how much of this is of interest to Esav, and why? Esav wants to know, has Yaakov gone into the livestock business? Is that will that make him happy? Says Yaakov, yes, this, too, is to mollify Esav. How so? Because, says Rashi, look at the brachas. It's further confirmation that the brachas of Yitzhak were not fulfilled through me. Because what are those brachas? Abba Amar Li, V'yitin l'cha ha'elokim mitala shamayim u'mishmane ha'aretz, the dew of the heavens, the fat of the land. That's agriculture. I never had a field. I never had any produce there. Zeh einu lo min ha'shamayim v'lo min ha'aretz, that I was successful, but not in the domain that the bracha was targeting. And once again, it sounds like the bracha was not fulfilled. Esav, in the meanwhile, has plenty of land, plenty of territory, and that is the general thrust of Yaakov's message. But having said all this, we now come to Rashi's second explanation of the word garti. And that is davar acher garti begematria taryag. Look at the word garti, you'll see it's a gematria, and in fact it's actually a very easy gematria. It's an anagram. It's the same letters, garti and taryag. Kilomar, as if to say, im love on harasha garti, v'taryag mitzvahs shamarti. I lived with love on the Russia, but I still kept taryag mitzvahs. Of course, Mefarshim immediately asked, did you keep all of taryag mitzvahs? There's certain mitzvahs that you can't fulfill when you're with love, and there's certain mitzvahs you couldn't fulfill at that time at all, etc. and so forth. And as we know, Yaakov married two sisters, which that's okay because the Torah hasn't been given. But then why are you saying that you kept taryag mitzvahs? And all these things are discussed. But the general point is, I kept taryag mitzvahs to the extent that I could, where relevant. Velo lamadati mimas of harayim. It means that I didn't learn from Lavan's evil deeds. And this now becomes a further intrigue, as if to say, how much of this will Esav be interested in? He's worried about Yaakov's Yiddishkeit. Maybe he's been faltering a little bit. Don't worry, I've been keeping mitzvahs. I'm sure you're very proud of me. One can't help noting that the direction or the connotation of the second Perush, it's not just different to the first Perush in so many ways. It's the opposite, almost, because this doesn't sound like words of appeasement. If you say to Esav, I was a lightweight personality, okay, have rachmanus on me. But if you say, I've been keeping taryag mitzvahs, the message is clear. Do not start with me, because I have merits. I've been keeping taryag mitzvahs. You should know who you'll be reckoning with. That's a very different type of message than the first one. The first one is, don't be angry with me. And the second is, do not mess with me. That's a different message. And it's possible that the two are blended, meaning it could be a composite message, as if to say, I'd like peace, but if you take the route of war, be aware. This messages are often blended in that way. If one country is under threat of aggression from another, they may send a message. We will do everything we can in our power to avoid a confrontation unless it's unavoidable. But that's a mixed message, meaning we want peace but prepared for war. Perhaps Yaakov is saying the same thing. But perhaps a more underlying question here. For whom the gematria? as if to say, we learn Parshas Vayishlach with the benefit of Rashi's commentary. Which means, if you didn't notice that Garti has the gematria of Taryag, you've got Rashi there to point it out for you. When Yaakov sends the message to Esav, we have to assume he does not send it with Rashi's commentary. Which means that when he says, Imlovan Garti, so what you see is what you get. Which means the only way that Esav would be able to be cognizant of this gematria is if he chapped it by himself, if he worked it out by himself. Which leads us to the question, how good is Esav in gematrias? Well, we don't know. It is true that Esav, until this point, thought that Yaakov was dead because Eliphaz told him that he killed him, as per last week, or at least he doesn't know where he is. Which means we also need to assume that when he receives the shocking news that after all these years, right, the 22 plus the original 14, and didn't know where Yaakov was, and finally Yaakov surfaces, he yet has the presence of mind to notice that the term used was Garti, and Garti presumably is Taryag. Wow, that's a high-level receiver. But is it really so? The matter becomes more intriguing still when we consult the words of the Medrash on Pasuk Vav. We come back to Yaakov's opening words there, Pasuk Vav, Vayihili shor v'chamor. I had an ox and a donkey. And again, we noted it's in the singular. Presumably it means he has many of each. Okay, it's a way of talking. But then enter the Medrash. And the Medrash says that Shor and Chamor are yet Yaakov's spiritual inventory. Another reference to the heavyweights that he has on his side. Who's Shor? Is Yosef? Bechor Shoro? Who's Chamor? Yisachar. Yisachar Chamor Gorem. He's got these individuals in his camp. And once again, the message is, know with whom you are reckoning. Because I've got Shor and I've got Chamor. Now, once again, we note this is quite different in direction to the Pshat. Because the Pshat is, I never made it in real estate, and I was never much of an in agriculture, the brachas, etc., do not be angry at me. And all of a sudden the Drash says, and I've got Yosef, and I've got Yisachar. This is no longer in the realms of gematrias. The identification or the association of Yosef, or we start with Yisachar as Chamor, those words were said by Yaakov almost 50 years in the future. I mean, they're from the brachos of Yaakov, Yisachar, Chamor Gorem. What chance in the world does Esav have of understanding that Shor means Yisachar? Firstly, he's never heard of Yisachar. He doesn't know how many children Yaakov have. When he meets them, he says, who are these people? So he doesn't know Yisachar even when he's called Yisachar. How's he possibly going to know that he's the Chamor that Yaakov is referring? Yaakov himself didn't call him a Chamor until just before he died. And what about Shor? Shor is Yosef. Bechor Shoro. Very nice. It's Beferish a Pasuk. It's a Pasuk in Vezos HaBracha. It was said by Moshe Rabbeinu in his brachas before he died. That's hundreds of years in the future. So he's not really giving Esav much of a chance. Let's put it that way. Which leads us to ask, for whom are these allusions? What does it mean? And these are important questions because, again, we know the Rashi, Garti, Taryag. But what does it really mean? And there is a fascinating approach which is actually built, in a sense, off comments of the Vilna Gaon on the one hand and the Noam Elimelech, one of the great Hasidic masters. I'm not sure how many discussions combine the two to get the desired result, but Baruch Hashem, that's what we're here for. So we start with the Gaon. And he refers to a very interesting statement of the Gemara in Maseches Megillah. Megillah, as we know, the end of the first chapter, has actually a Gemara commentary on Megillas Esther. It's five or six huge dapim. And the Gemara in Megillah comments on Esther's, when she finally identifies who her adversary is. Achashverosh is saying, Mihuzeh ve'ezahu, he's so wound up, the first party and the second party, and finally, and who is it? She says, Nimkarnani v'ami, we've been sold. Who is this? The Pasuk says, Vatomer Esther Malka, Vatomer Amelech Achashverosh. She said, So, So Vatomer Ish Tsarva Oyev Haman Hara Hazeh. Okay, says the Gemara. When she says Ish Tsarva Oyev, she began to point at Achashverosh, because he really is a silent partner in the whole thing. He is the adversary of the Jewish people no less than Haman. Haman can't move without Achashverosh. He didn't know. And a malach came, and whatever that means, that a malach comes and moved her hand to Haman. Ish Tsarva Oyev starts to move in the direction of Achashverosh, but then it gets pushed back to Haman Hara Hazeh. And of course the question is, this is not the time to make a moral point like that. When you need the good graces of Achashverosh, which for sure she does, this is not the time to say, and you're just as bad as him, because how well disposed do you think he's going to be to your cause after that? And therefore the question is, what is behind Esther's motions here? She starts to point towards Achashverosh. That is a question that needs to be addressed, whether it's Purim or not. And the Vilna Gaon says, it's a chiddush, but it's not his chiddush. It's actually based directly from the Gemara, not surprisingly. And that is, as we know, sometimes when a person is, when his thoughts are wrapped up in something, it will express itself in his words, even if it's not actually relevant to the conversation at hand. I mean, there's many ways to refer to that. A simple example, when someone is thinking, their mind is caught up with Reuven. So even when they're talking to Shimon, they might call him Reuven by mistake, or conversationally they're meant to be talking about Shimon, but they say Reuven because they're thinking about Reuven. Okay, says the Vilna Gaon. We need to remember, Tzaddikim, the way that they operate, it's not just that they are righteous people, which of course they are. They have a consciousness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which pervades everything that they do. When they look at the world, they look at the world as a connection with Hashem. And their thoughts are never far from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, especially when they're in the presence of royalty. Because royalty itself is a temporal expression of Malchus of Hashem. And therefore, sometimes if a tzaddik, a person of that stature, we're talking about that stature, is in the presence of royalty, their mind logs into HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Says Vilna Gaon, everything that I just said to you is from the Gemara. Where does the Gemara talk about this? You know, in Maseches Shavuos, which is on Daf Lamed Hey, it talks about the names of Hashem, which are Kodesh, which are Chol. It goes through, or which words in the Tanakh are referring to Hashem, and which not. Okay, in most cases it's clear, but there are some unique situations. The Gemara refers to Sefer Daniel, Perek Dalet. What happens? Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. He has like a few dreams there in Sefer Daniel. And Daniel is called in to interpret it. And Daniel's words are, it's Daniel Perek Dalet, Mare, my master, Chelma Lesonach. But the dream involves things being destroyed. My master, this dream should be for your enemies. Okay, who's he talking to? Well, the answer seems quite clear. He's standing right in front of Nebuchadnezzar. He's talking about Nebuchadnezzar's dream, which means my master, Nebuchadnezzar, this dream should be fulfilled through your enemies, and they should all be destroyed. Says the Gemara in Shavuos, Daf Lamed Hey, that word, Mari, my master, is Kodesh. It cannot be erased, because it refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Here's Daniel, and he's Daniel, and he's standing in front of Nebuchadnezzar, but he has such a sense of the real situation of the world, Jewish destiny, v'chule, world events. And when he hears his dream, his primary thought is addressing Hashem, my master, may this dream be fulfilled through your enemies. And the result is that word mare, my master, is a shem kodesh, so says the Gemara. Well, says the Vilna Gaon, that is the understanding of that Gemara in Megillah about Esther. When she starts to say Ish Tsarva Oyev, because her primary point of communion is not with Achashverosh, it's with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when you talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the first oppressor is Achashverosh. And that's why she instinctively points towards Achashverosh. The Malach almost like wakes her up from that consciousness, from that sense of connection, and brings her back to talking to Achashverosh. When you talk to Achashverosh, the oppressor is Haman. When you talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the oppressor is Achashverosh, no less. Well, Adkan from the words of the Vilna Gaon. But now, the Inyaneinu, we move to the Noam Elimelech, who explains exactly the same phenomenon is occurring in the beginning of Vayishlach. It's a very decisive time. Yaakov's about to meet Esav. His thoughts are focused as much on HaKadosh Baruch Hu as they are Esav, which means that as much as, and at the same time as he's giving this message to Esav, and Esav is only going to chap and catch the simple meaning of the words. He's not going to get gematrias, he's not going to get midrashim, he's not going to get references that are based on psukkim that haven't been said, so on and so forth. That's not for him. But why are they part and parcel of Yaakov's words? Because he's connected with HaKadosh Baruch Hu even as he's talking to Esav. So the very same words have now these two planes of meaning, whereby the simple meaning is for Esav, but then there's inner meaning, which is almost like a prayer. He's not saying to Esav, he's not threatening Esav or intimidating Esav or establishing his spiritual credentials to Esav, but rather he's saying, as he's saying to Esav, I was a lightweight personality. He's saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, remember, I kept the mitzvahs. When he says to Esav, I had animals but not land, he's saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, remember, look who I have. I've got in the merit of Yosef and Yisachar and all of the others. Tzon itself is the rest of Bnei Yisrael. And this then is the dual, it is a dual meaning, because it's actually two conversations that are happening at the same time, which is a fascinating insight into these well-known, again, comments of Rashi and Chazal in the beginning of the Parsha. Okay. Moving on from the first two or three psukim here, let's come to the famous confrontation between Yaakov and this Malach, Vayavik Ish Imo. And that is in Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Kaf Gimel to Kaf Hei. And the psukim read, Vayakam Balaila, who first the background, Vayikachesh Deinashav, he gets up that night, he takes his wife, Teshiv Chosav, his two handmaidens, Achadas Hayeladav, the 11 children, Binyamin had not yet been born, Vayavor Esma Vayabok, he crosses them over the stream of Yabok, Vayikachem, Vayavirem Esanacha, he takes them, cross them over, Vayaver Esashalo, and also then crosses over, transports all of his things. Vayivosa Yaakov Levado, Pasuk Kafe. Then he remains by himself. He's there alone, left alone. Vayavikish imo, and someone fights with him ad alos hashachar, until the morning. This is enigmatic in the extreme. All we know, he's there by himself. Someone fights with him until the morning. It's clear from the psukim, this is not a normal person. The pasuk doesn't say who he is, but Yaakov starts asking him for brachos and etc. and so forth, and that is clearly Chazal tell us that he is Soror Shel Esav. That means that this is Esav's spiritual overseer. Prior to Yaakov meeting Esav in the flesh, he first needs to contend with the spiritual overseer of Esav. Now, if the one that he's wrestling with is a spiritual being, then we need to consider what is the nature of this fight. I mean, what does it look like? Clearly, a confrontation with a spiritual being is a spiritual confrontation. But it's equally clear that it has reverberations in the physical realm. By the time he wakes up, he's limping. So it somehow it will impact on his physical state. But it's not a wrestling match in that way. I mean, it's not to test Yaakov's physical strength. Esav can do that. He doesn't need Sarah Shel Esav to do that. But the pasuk doesn't say what it is about. It just says Vayavik Ish Imo. We're told basically nothing. There's a very interesting statement of the Gemara, it's in Maseches Chulin, Daf Tzadik Aleph, which focuses on the word Vayi'ovek, because that itself is an interesting word. It's one of the words the Torah does use, does tell us, Vayi'ovek. But what does Vayi'ovek mean? So again, we translate as he struggled, yeah. And a Ma'avak is a struggle. But why is a Ma'avak a struggle? I mean, what does it mean? Rashi tells us, the word Ma'avak relates to the word avak. Avak is dust. So how does dust come to mean struggle? And Rashi comments and explains that when people, paraphrasing his words, when people wrestle and they stomp around, so they'll raise dust. But it's very interesting that the whole confrontation is then cooled after the dust that they raised, and not the confrontation itself. Especially as, had they not been standing on dust, they wouldn't have raised any dust. If they'd been standing on the grass, so then none of this would have happened. But it still would have been a struggle. Does it make a difference where they are? So it's interesting that what almost seemed to be like a side point in the whole thing, it's true, if people are in dust and they stomp around, dust will rise up. But that becomes the motif term. And that's why the Gemara has a further comment. The Gemara says, not only did they raise dust, she'elu avak ad lekisei hakovah, they raised dust until the throne of glory. As we can appreciate, the Gemara too seemingly is responding to the word vayavik. It's like a key word. But of course, the Gemara's words themselves need to be understood. How is it possible to raise dust to the Kisei HaKavod? For any number of reasons. If the Kisei HaKavod, firstly, is a concept and not an actual place, so then there's no way that dust can ever get there. And how can dust meaningfully be raised to any altitude beyond, etc. and so forth? Which means clearly Chazal are communicating an idea to us, and the question, of course, is, what is that idea? Okay. Why is Yaakov alone? Again, Pasuk doesn't say. If you just read the Pasuk, it's so quickly. He's alone and he's fighting. But why is he alone? So here too, we have a comment of Chazal. Rashi quotes it. He went back for the famous Pachim Ketanim, these small jars. He left them there and he went back for them. And as Mefarshim explain, it's got to be something of practically no significance, because the Pasuk already said he's moved his things for the other side. If he moved his things to the other side, so it sounds like there's nothing left. If there's nothing left, why is he still here? It has to be that it's the equivalent of nothing, even though it's something. And then you'll find Pachim Ketanim, these small jars. But the question remains, why do we need to know this? Especially when we remember that the Pasuk has told us almost nothing about this confrontation, but it does give us this detail. We don't know who the Pasuk doesn't say who this person was, what the fight was about. All it says, all we know is, he went back for Pachim Ketanim. Why is that so relevant to us? And secondly, if we may ask, why go back for Pachim Ketanim? I mean, that's the pre-question. They are practically worthless, as is evidenced by the fact that that's how we know he went back for them, because they're almost like they don't exist. But he still goes back for them. But why? And somehow, all of this is the prelude. It's the only thing we hear just before the fight begins. But why is it the prelude? Does it make a difference? Is this related to the fight? So these questions are discussed by Rabbi Yosef Salant in his Perush Be'er Yosef, one of the great works on Torah to come out in recent decades. And the truth is that the reason why the Torah says he went back for Pachim Ketanim, that is to say, the reason why the Torah indicates that he's by himself, which gives us the understanding that it's for these small jars, and then leads into the fight, is because the fight was about going back for these small jars. It's the prelude to the fight, because it's the basis of the fight. And what does this mean? Mefarshim explain, each one in their own way. Chazal already talked about it. The Arizal says it in his way. Why does Yaakov go back for Pachim Ketanim? They seem almost worthless. But the truth is that Yaakov's going back for these small jars, which have almost no worth, is a statement. It's a statement of hashgacha. That is, and what is hashgacha? Hashgacha is divine supervision, divine interaction. And for Yaakov, his sense of connectedness, as we spoke about from before, even when he talks to Esav, he's talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his sense of connectedness tells him that everything he has for a reason. As if to say, to a certain degree, everyone has a sense of why things are the way they are, at least in a general way. A person has a sense of why they live where they live, of why they do the job that they do. That's their calling. They understand that's what they should be doing. And of major events, it's possible to see why this happened. For most people, we leave it at major events, but it's hard to then, hard. We rarely do we then translate that into day-to-day events, even though they are, in a sense, the capillaries of these arteries. That means if a person, he knows why he has a certain job. That's clear to him, that's what he's meant to do. He feels that's his calling. But that might not necessarily tell him why it is that he had the any given job on any given day. If a person is a doctor, right? There's a reason it's a doctor, and that's clear, that's what he's meant to do, etc. But why did he see this patient on this day? That's already, these are details. The sense of calling doesn't always factor into small things. But the higher a person goes, the more it does, because there's an expression of the same idea. Which means if you're Yaakov Avinu, which is basically pretty much as high as you go, so then for Yaakov, everything is clear to him that it's his for a reason. It's part of his role in this world. Even down to the most insignificant, seemingly, items called Pachim Ketanim. And that's why he goes back. And moreover, that is the beginning of his war with Soror Shel Esav. Who is Soror Shel Esav, and what does he represent? He is the spiritual vision of Esav. Esav is not that interested in connectivity with anyone higher. From Esav will come Amalek, right? The masters of disconnect between higher realms and lower realms. As far as Esav is concerned, it's all mikra. There's no such thing. Nothing is guided in any way. And the spiritual confrontation between Soror Shel Esav and Yaakov will be on this very point, on outlook, on approach to life, on the way that life should be led. But as we can appreciate, and as we know, the Yetzer Hara, he doesn't start with a person at their strongest point. He starts with a person at their extremities. I mean, that's the battle is always at these extreme things. A person who's already committed to good things. So the Yetzer Hara is not going to say, don't do them. But he might say, you don't need to do them to such an extensive degree, or whatever it is. He goes to shul, right? He's a regular shul goer. But does he need to be on time or early? And how much does he talk in shul? I mean, these are in a sense, the finer points. So the Yetzer Hara is not going to say, don't daven. But he'll allow you room for a Shalom Aleichem, and then maybe a little bit more, etc. and so forth. All of these are small jars. All of these are the extreme. Everyone has these extremities. And that's where the war begins. And therefore the Pasuk says, Yaakov went back for Pachim Ketanim, and someone is waiting there to fight with him over this, over going back for these small jars. Because how does it begin? He says, hello, Yaakov, what brings you here? I'm back for Pachim Ketanim. Really? They're a little small. They seem a little worthless. Why did you come back for them? Well, I think they're important. Why? Because they're part of the assets that I have, and things they have are there for a reason. Okay, maybe. But even these Pachim Ketanim, I mean, Pachim Gedolim, so then there's what to talk about. I understand why you have as many children as you have, and I understand why you live where you live, b'chule, b'chule. But down to the Pachim Ketanim, and that's where it begins. But if he manages to chap Yaakov on the Pachim Ketanim, so then the Pachim Ketanim do become Pachim Gedolim. And before you look around, you belong to Esav, and nothing is guided, and nothing. There's no sense of mission in anything, or higher calling in anything, which means, in a sense, one could say that Yaakov's war with Soror Shel Esav took the form of staying firm on his stance that it's worth it to go back for Pachim Ketanim. That's what they war about. And this brings us to the word Vayavik. Because the word Vayavik is the word the Torah chooses to depict the struggle. But why? Avak means dust. It doesn't mean struggle. But the struggle is about dust. Because dust is the quintessential insignificant item. It's dust. It's nothing. And that's the point. Because Yaakov is going back for dust. And the Mala says, but that's nothing. It's not even important. But for Yaakov it's important because of his sense of connectivity. And that's why the term used is Vayavik. They're really warring over dust. And moreover, the Gemara portrays it and expresses it, Melamed Shehelu Avak Adlekise HaKavod. They raise dust until the throne of glory. What does that mean? It's not about the how far the dust went, how far it shot up, etc. What it means is the Kise HaKavod represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu's supervision over the world. We say, Galui V'yadua, Lifnei Kisei Chavodecha. And that's actually a bit of an irony, because for a temporal king, the more honored he is and the more glorified he is, the less he pays attention to the small details of his subjects. But for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's not that way. And that's his kavod, we say, V'hi tehi lasecha, that the kisei HaKavod, we say in the Baruch of Asher Yotzer, even over the most basic, mundane physical actions, we say, Galui v'yadu lefnei kisei chavodecha. What a place to mention the kisei HaKavod. Ask the Vilna Gaon. What a place to mention the kisei HaKavod. Yes, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved in the ongoing function, even down to these very mundane things of every person. And that's kavodo. That's the kisei HaKavod. Which means when the Gemara says they raise dust till the kisei HaKavod, it's not a description of the effects of their struggle. It's a description of the essence of the struggle. It's about, do things like dust, do they also reach the kisei HaKavod? The Kodesh Baruch Hu supervise those things as well. And this is the struggle, which goes on all night. Yaakov stays firm, but as we know, he hit him in the thigh, he hit him in the hip, in the nerve, representing his children, his progeny. Not all of Yaakov's children are on the Madriga of Yaakov, and this remains as something of a fall, which will come out in future generations. So this is a very fascinating understanding of this confrontation, about which the psukim themselves are so enigmatic, as we said. And what is the legacy, in a sense? What's the legacy of this battle? It becomes a mitzvah, amazingly, and it's one of the three mitzvahs that exist in Chumash Bereishis. There are almost no mitzvahs there, except there's Peru Revu, and there's Mila, and Gidanoshe. And that's it. So in terms of distribution of mitzvahs, it's three down in Chumash Bereishis, and then 610 to go in the next four Chumashim. And if we see the way the Torah describes the Gidan Asher there, which is in Pasuk Lamed Gimel, because Pasuk Lamed Beis ends by saying, V'utzolei Ayurecha, he was limping. And that, once again, that's the interface, the point of fusion between the spiritual confrontation, but its physical outcome is that he's limping. And moreover, Pasuk Lamed Gimel says, Al Kain, Lo yochlu bnei Yisrael eskid hanoshe asher al kafeirich ad hayom hazeh. Therefore, bnei Yisrael will not eat the gidanoshe until this time. Kinoga b'chaf yerech Yaakov begid hanoshe, because he was able to score that knock against Yaakov in the gid hanoshe, as we said, referring to Yaakov's descendants, or at least some of them. There is a fascinating and major comment of the Rambam with regards to Gid HaNoshe, and it's to be found in his commentary on the Mishnayos in the seventh Perek of Maseches Chulin, which is actually called Perek Gid HaNoshe, and that's where these things are discussed in the Mishnayos. And Rambam is now on record with a major statement about mitzvos, because it's an interesting thing. Where do mitzvos come from? And where, based on what are they obligatory, from when, and which event, and so on and so forth. Says Rambam, V'sim libcha leklal hagadol hazeh. Pay close attention to this major principle. It's always wonderful, the Rambam, when he has something major to say, you know, because he tells you. He's about to say something major. he's teaching us. Tzarich ladat. You need to know. Shekol ma she'anu nizharim mimenu. Anything that we avoid, that is to say, as a negative prohibition. O osim oso, or perform, as a positive mitzvah. Ein anu osim zos, ela mipnei tzivui Hashem, al yidei Moshe. Those obligations derive purely and exclusively from Hashem's instructions through Moshe to the Jewish people from Matan Torah. Lo mipnei she'Hashem tziva bekach le'neviim. Not because shekadmu, not because Hashem instructed any Navi that came before. For example, dugma lekach, ein anu ochlim eivim menachai. So we avoid eivim menachai, a limb from a live animal. It's one of the Torah mitzvahs. Lo mipnei she'Hashem asur al bnei Noach eivim menachai. Not because Hashem forbade it for bnei Noach. Elo mipnei she'Moshe asur aleinu eivim menachai b'mashinetzdav b'sinai. It was through Moshe as he was commanded at Sinai. That is a relatively straightforward example because Eivim Menachai originally encompasses all of humankind. But for us, it's one of the Torah mitzvahs, it had another iteration at Sinai. But what about Mila? V'chein, ein anu malim b'glal she'avram malis atma v'anshei beiso. Our obligation in the mitzvah of Mila does not derive back to the mitzvah that was given to Avram, as if to say it was given to Avram, and from that point forward, all of his descendants, or however those descendants become the Jewish people, are likewise obligated based on that original mitzvah. No. El mipnei she'Hashem tzivanu ayidei Moshe lihimo k'moshe mal Avraham. It's Hashem's command through Moshe. V'chein gid hanoshe. The same thing gid hanoshe. When we do not partake of the Gid HaNoshe, it's not because of any issur that existed with Yaakov. Ein aninim shachim b'achrei issur Yaakov avinu elitzivu Moshe Rabbeinu. So all of these bracious mitzvos, Eivim Menachai and Mila and Gid HaNoshe and all of that, our mitzvah does not derive from those episodes, and even if mitzvahs were given at those episodes, but it all comes back from Sinai, that's the event which is now Machai of all these things. Halotire. Concluding two lines of Rambam. Behold, Amaram. What does the Gemara say in Makos? Shloshmios, Sheshmios v'shloshes a mitzvos nemru la Moshe mis-Sinai. 630 mitzvos were given to Moshe at Sinai. That's the Gemara at the end of Maseches Makos. That tells you, v'kol eile, all of these prior mitzvos are all b'chlala mitzvos. They're all part of 613. Anything that pre-existed Sinai gets now obligated by force of Sinai and not before. Now, what's very interesting is, and this Rav Kuperman points out just for the final two or three moments, is that as much as, it's really, you can see it from the Mishnah there in Chulin, as much as we say that Gid HaNoshe, the case at hand, it's something that's forbidden, but it's from Sinai. But the Pasuk in the Torah, there's only one place in the Torah where it talks about Gid HaNoshe, that's Parshas Vayishlach. And Parshas Vayishlach is before Parshas Yisro, which describes Sinai. Which means, says Rav Kuperman, in Sefer Pshuto Shel Mikra, one needs to distinguish when we talk about where do mitzvahs come from as obligations. Not from prior to Sinai, that means not from a historical event before Sinai. But Sinai is where the Torah is given. Which can include psukim that are written in Parshas that describe things that were before Sinai. Because that was all itself part of what's given at Sinai. Which means, just to pin that down, make it crystal clear, is that if we say, what is the, historically, what is mechayev us in the, what obligates us to avoid Eivim Menachai? The answer is the event of Matan Torah at Har Sinai. From that point on, we become obligated. If we then ask a question, where is the source, where is the Pasuk in the Torah which talks about this? The answer is, it's in Vayishlach. But the Pasuk of Vayishlach is addressing the Jewish people when they are receiving the Torah. So one shouldn't confuse historically before Matan Torah with parshanically before Parshas Yisro. But the fascinating point, and with this we'll conclude, is that looked at in this way, the very same words of Pasuk Lamed Gimel have two entirely different meanings. One is Pshat and one is Drash, and the two live side by side. What do we mean by this? Pasuk Lamed Beis describes what happened with Yaakov. And then Pasuk Lamed Gimel says, Al Kain, therefore, Lo Yochlu B'nei Yisrael Eskid HaNoshe Asher Al Kaf HaYarech. Now, as we know, the word lo can either be description, this doesn't happen, or an instruction, this shall not happen, this cannot happen. Which is it here? The answer is both. Because there is no question that in context, the words lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael, which are written in Chumash Bereishis, and is yet the Torah describing. So b'nei Yisrael refer to Yaakov's children. Yisrael, there is Yaakov, and b'nei Yisrael are his children onwards. And lo yochlu describes their nohag, that they would not eat the git hanoshe. And that's the pshat. And it remains the pshat. The drash is that b'nei Yisrael in the pasuk is actually Hashem talking to the Jewish people about themselves. Therefore, let the Jewish people, b'nei Yisrael, not eat git hanoshe. So you see that not only does the pasuk exist, shall we say, on two tiers, with the pshat as the narrative describing a nohag, and the B'nai Yisrael in question are Yaakov's direct children. The first of B'nai Yisrael were his 11 sons, and then the 12 sons. And that's the pshat of the pasuk. But that doesn't give you a mitzvah, because describing what they did isn't not telling you what to do. Which means that the Medrash Halacha, from which Halacha is derived, which looks at these words, Lo Yochlu B'nei Yisrael, the very same words. And they never stop being pshat, but they're also drash. And Lo Yochlu B'nei Yisrael is a command to B'nei Yisrael. And B'nei Yisrael here is no longer Yaakov's sons. It's the Jewish people as they stand at Sinai. And it's a classic example, not only of the different approaches of pshat and drash, but how the two coexist, because both are true. The pshat is depicting the narrative, and the drash gives us the mitzvah as B'nai Yisrael. We'll leave it over there.